Okie dokie. I think it's time to kick off. Thanks for coming along to the session. My name is Mitch Denny, and the title of this session is Adding PowerShell Support to Enterprise Applications. Before I get started, I want to try and understand who's in the room. So I asked this question when there was a few less people in the room, but who's an IT pro in the audience? Okay, I thought I'd get a couple. So this is actually a developer session, but don't run off. Because if you're interested in going back to your software engineering team and requesting that they actually add some manageability to their applications, well, this will give you some ammunition. And I'm all for improving the manageability of applications. But I will be showing code as well as PowerShell scripting. So just a quick heads up on that. For the software developers in the audience, because all IT pros would already know PowerShell, right? But for the software developers in the audience, who uses PowerShell every single day? Okay, keep your hands up for the next 3 hours. Who uses NuGet? Oh, well, you guys are already using PowerShell. Okay, who creates ASP.NET applications with Visual Studio? Well, you guys are using PowerShell. When you use package management in Visual Studio, it's basically pushed through a PowerShell layer. So in the development space, we're starting to see PowerShell everywhere we look. And one of the things that we can start to do as developers actually get more familiar with PowerShell and start providing management interfaces to our applications with PowerShell. So that's kind of what this session is about. So the way I've structured this is I'm going to do a bit of a PowerShell primer, because a lot of people, even though you use PowerShell, don't necessarily know the basics of it. I'm not going to spend a whole heap of time on this, but I'm just going to sort of quickly race through that so you can get a sense of what it is. And as a developer, you'll probably find a lot of the concepts very, very familiar. In fact, when we get into the 101, I'll talk about the way PowerShell works, and that will kind of explain why it's so familiar. Then we're going to look at building some custom modules. So this is the basic steps of building your own components of PowerShell that enable a system administrator to actually manage your application. And then as a final demonstration, what I'm going to do is add some PowerShell management commandlets, which you'll understand after this session, to an online application. So I'm going to pick on, who's heard of Nerd Dinner? Yep, a couple of people. So Nerd Dinner is an open source project by Microsoft to demonstrate ASP.NET MVC and a few other technologies. And I'm going to add PowerShell support to that. Okay, so as a bit of an example. So that's the rough agenda for today. Hopefully I can stick to time and also have plenty of time for Q&A. Feel free just to shout out if you've got a question. It's a small room, so I'll repeat your question just to make sure I understand it, and then I'll see if I can answer it. Okay, so PowerShell Primer. Just look through that. The 101 of PowerShell is really first about understanding what it is. So PowerShell is a command shell. So a lot of developers will sort of spin up cmd.exe and start issuing commands on the command prompt. PowerShell is an alternative to cmd.exe. And in fact, it's the path forward for doing command-orientated operations in Windows. And it's been around for quite some time. We're currently, I think it's version 3, but it's getting revved all the time with each version of Windows. As well as being an interactive command prompt, it's also a scripting language. So the commands that you type in the command prompt, you can save into a text file and execute as a script. We'll see all this in action in a second. But PowerShell itself is actually a .NET application. It was built in .NET. And that's kind of unusual for some of the components in Windows. When PowerShell was first introduced into Windows, it actually was a separate download and required the .NET runtime to be installed on the machine. Now .NET's baked into the platform. It's on for quite some time. .NET's been in the platform. So PowerShell's in the box, and PowerShell's getting revved with every version of Windows. And the surface area that PowerShell can access in terms of managing a computer is increasing all the time. And I've seen some dramatic pickups in the amount of things you can do with PowerShell on a machine. A lot of that was driven via... who's familiar with Windows Server Core? Okay. So Windows Server Core is like a version of Windows which is really slimmed down in terms of the UI components that are deployed on the machine, so it really reduces the size of the installation. Now, the side effect of doing that is all of the previous management UI that you had on the Windows machine that you might use to administer the server, you can't use anymore. And so they provide management of those machines using PowerShell. Okay? So if you're running or your application is running in a big lights-out data center, it's possible that some of your components might be running on a core server. And so potentially, the only management user interface you could provide to your application is actually PowerShell or some other sort of web UI. Okay? So it's important to understand what PowerShell is and the impact it's going to have on you as a software developer. I think TechEd, 3-4 years ago, I gave a presentation on PowerShell. And PowerShell's moved on a little bit since then. We have sort of understand how it fits into the ecosystem a bit better. The demos I gave there were a bit trivial, weren't really enterprise-focused. What I'm going to be doing here is trying to sort of make the connection with enterprise development. So let's get started with some basics of PowerShell usage. So I'll just flick my machine here. Okay, lovely orange desktop background. And what I'm going to do is bring up the PowerShell command prompt. So this is PowerShell. And on the surface, it feels like any other DOS-like command prompt. So I can type in a command like dir, and I get some results on the screen. So if you didn't know any better, you'd think that would be something like cmd.exe. What's actually happening here is dir is actually just an alias for a thing called a commandlet. So when you invoke things on the command prompt, you're actually ultimately invoking these things called commandlets. They're little bits of code which take parameters and then spit out objects. So even though that looks like it's sprayed out text onto the screen, it's actually sprayed out objects onto the screen. And the rendering engine inside the shell has just decided the best way of presenting it. So dir is ultimately an alias for a commandlet called getChildItem. So if I type in getChildItem, then I get the same result. Now, the nice thing about PowerShell is because it's actually objects, I can actually change the way that this stuff's displayed on the screen. So if I wanted to go getChildItem, I could actually format the output as a table with the name and the length. Okay, so now I've got the output is just name and length. Pretty versatile, right? Well, the reason it's so versatile and the reason I love working with PowerShell so much is it's actually just .NET under the covers. So if I issue the command getChildItem down the bottom there of the screen, so let me scroll that up a little bit, and I pipe it to another command called getMember. So now I'm using two commandlets. I invoke getChildItem, it sprays out a whole bunch of objects, and then those objects get piped into another commandlet called getMember, and getMember prints on the screen the different types of the objects that are available to me. So if I hit enter there, I've got all this output on the screen. And if I scroll up, if you're a .NET developer, this will look instantly familiar. So that's a class from the .NET framework. So system.io file info. And you can see that, in general, it has a bunch of members on it, so methods and properties. It's also got a couple of additional properties. So one of the things you can do with PowerShell is augment the .NET type system, just so that it's more convenient for working in the shell. We won't necessarily go into that today, but you can actually extend the type system in .NET. So you might want to use an out-of-the-box type, but have an extra property on it, which is effectively just another script or some piece of annotated data. So in this case, getMember printed out multiple tables because this directory actually contains directories and files info. So we've got directory info and file info. And it's telling me what the distinct properties and methods are on each of those. Okay? So PowerShell is just .NET. To give you some idea of the scale of the commands that you've got inside PowerShell and the flexibility, if I issue the command getCommand, it will print out all of the commands that are available to me in this command prompt. So I'll execute that command. There we go. So out of the box, it's a pretty impressive command shell. So there'll be a test at the end of it. You've got to just be able to read out every single one of those commands. I want sort of encyclopedic knowledge. Of course, most people who use PowerShell don't remember all the commands, so you need to have some kind of help system. So if I want to get help, I can type in get help, and then I could type in the commandlet that I want help for. So I could say get help, get child item, and it prints out effectively like a man page. Okay, and there's different levels of help you can get, so the help for get child item actually goes for like 5 pages or something like that. This is like the brief summary of the help, so you can quickly figure out what commands you can issue. Okay. Bear with me. So a few terms, and they're going to be useful as we get into this a little bit later on. When I issue a command, like get command, this is called an invocation. Okay, so I'm making an invocation on the command shell, and this is a pipeline of commands that are strung together. And so if I go get command, measure object, so I'm piping all of the results from get command into measure object. You sort of think of this as a pipeline with stages. Okay, now the measure object commandlet has a simple function of summing or averaging or whatever we want to do the data that's coming down the pipeline. So I did that get command previously and it just printed out a whole bunch of stuff. But if I hit get commands and pipe that into measure object, it's going to give me a sum of the number of commandlets that run on the machine. And this result itself is actually just an object. So I can say get command, measure object, and then I can pipe that to get member, and I can figure out what data is available to me on the, in this case, the generic measure info object. So this is just sort of getting up to speed with how this works. The next thing I want to do is, so we've been playing with command prompt now. You can actually just type all these commands into a PowerShell PS1 file, and then you just make those scripts reusable. So if I go into my environment here, and I type in notepad hello world.ps1. There we go. And what I can actually do is issue these commands. So I might type in write object hello world. So now I'm just doing some lightweight scripting using PowerShell. And if I invoke that command, notepad. So one of the things, this always gets me, because I started using PowerShell when it first came out, the initial builds of PowerShell used write object instead of write output. And because I developed PowerShell commandlets, the API inside PowerShell is actually write object, not write output. So it's one of those things that catches me out all the time. There we go, hello world. So that's your basic scripting. And you can basically compose these commands out of sequences of commands strung together. And there's also if blocks and loops and all of that kind of stuff. I'm not necessarily going to go into the detail of that syntax here. The help system actually has a whole bunch of topics that you can get access to. So often things like help about and then some topic. So, all right, so the next thing I want to do is start moving on to the benefits of PowerShell, which is on a different screen. Okay, so if you're a software developer and you're looking at where you spend your time, I'm trying to convince you that you should spend at least a little bit of time investing in PowerShell in your project, just so that your system administrators don't randomly change password on you, right? Because they don't like you because the software that you're producing is not manageable. So the benefits from PowerShell, from my point of view, is that it's actually a minimal investment. You know, we're talking in a session here which is like an hour long, an hour 15 long, and we're going to actually build up a PowerShell module multiple times and make it work. because the PowerShell commandlets that you write are just little chunks of functionality, you get quite a bit of composability. And you can combine the PowerShell commandlets you write with the PowerShell commandlets that Microsoft provides or other third-party vendors provide. And so that's the sum is greater than the parts. The other thing is, particularly as a developer, if you write PowerShell commandlets and you're dealing with an issue in production, because when PowerShell pipes something out to the console, it's really the .NET object, then it can expose some internals which might be useful for dealing with crisis situations. So for example, and we'll see this in the final demo, you can write PowerShell commandlets which expose access in the database. So let's say you're using Entity Framework to access the database or some other sort of ORM. You can actually return those objects themselves and actually call methods and access properties on the objects and then potentially save those records back. Okay, so it's quite a powerful technique. And finally, it actually improves developer productivity. And as I get into developing the demo a little bit, you'll see how you can actually use PowerShell when you execute the program. So you can hit F5, PowerShell comes up, does a bunch of things automatically every single time you do debugging on your application. And then, so you can do things like set up databases and that kind of stuff. So you can have a bunch of scripts that live inside your project that allow developers to get things done quickly every single time they debug the app. Before you race off and implement PowerShell in your applications, it's prudent to understand what some of the other options are. And the first one is do nothing. Okay, so a lot of applications that I see don't have any management user interface at all. So they just it's a website that you drop down, you point it to a database, and that's all you need to do. And there's not much beyond the basic functionality of the application you need to do. So if you're doing a mostly content-based website, which is mostly just static, you don't necessarily need to add PowerShell support to that. All right, so nothing is a valid response sometimes. But as your application starts becoming more sophisticated, and you're looking through your backlog of user stories for your application, at some point, administration considerations are going to hit that backlog and start moving up. And that becomes more true the closer you get to that production deployment. And the sysadmins should have some voice in that team, into the decision, so coming through the product owner, depending on what methodology you're using. Sometimes what people do is build an internal administration UI within the application. So if let's say you've got a web app, you go to //service/admin, all right, and you log in with a special set of credentials, and then you can do things in the application. Who's done that kind of thing in an app before? All right, it's pretty common, right? So it's probably the second most common option after doing nothing, right? Now, usually that administration site takes dependencies on some of the plumbing of that application. So let's say that something goes wrong. Let's say that the database schema is corrupted some way and you go to access the administration site. What's going to happen? It's not going to work, right? So the system administrators in the room can probably attest to the value of having some kind of out-of-band management facility in an for managing an environment. That's why you have configuration management tools, so you can externally manage things when they go wrong. So that brings us to the third option, which is building a separate administration site. Now, I've seen that done a couple of times as well. So that the separate administration site isn't necessarily dependent on the application working correctly, so potentially it can be used to recover the application if something goes wrong. Okay, so let's say there's just some bad data and the admin site just allows that sort of very crude data manipulation capability. But you've still got to have that site up and running, so there's still dependencies like IIS and databases and all of that kind of stuff that you need to deal with. The other option is, and this has some of the same issues of taking dependencies because where do these scripting engines run, but you could use another scripting interface. You don't have to use PowerShell. You could use something like F#. In fact, I was talking about this session to one of the guys at work, and he pointed out that they tried using PowerShell, but they didn't have that much success. And so they decided to build an F# scripting interface, and that worked quite well for them. I would argue that PowerShell development has actually become a lot easier in the more recent versions of PowerShell. So, in his case, I would encourage him to look again at doing things in PowerShell because it's actually considerably simpler than what it used to be. Okay, so we're about a third through, so hopefully we'll go all right for time. The next thing I want to look at is building custom modules. So you've got some basic understanding of what PowerShell is. Now it's time to jump in and start extending it. So we're going to look at a couple of areas. We're going to look at the basics of module creation. And then once you've created the module, we're going to look at how you can do development and debugging of that module. I'm a big believer in the ability of a developer to do a clone or a get latest of the version control system, hit F5 and start working. Right? I don't like setting up development environments. I don't like necessarily having lots of random stuff you've got to change all over the place. And that's true of managing PowerShell development, but also PowerShell can actually help solve that problem for other dependencies in the application. Because with PowerShell, you can do things like manipulate SQL Server or configure IIS or do all sorts of random things. And then finally, I want to look at some of the design considerations around how you target your PowerShell commandlets. But I'll get onto that in a little bit more detail later on. It'll become apparent why that's important. So let's look at module creation. Since I gave my talk at TechEd 3 or 4 years ago, module creation's actually evolved. Previously, if you wanted to extend PowerShell, you had to write this thing called a PS snap-in. Okay? And a PS snap-in was it was at least two classes. It was a class that was derived from the installer class in the .NET framework, or a PS snap-in class, which was ultimately derived from the installer class. And in that class, you would set a bunch of properties which define the metadata about the extension that you were building. So you'd have things like the author, company name, all of that kind of stuff. And then you'd actually have to install that PowerShell snap-in. And when you installed it, it would actually put an entry in the registry so that the PowerShell command prompts, wherever they were, knew how to discover that snap-in. Fast forward to the current version of PowerShell, there's actually now multiple ways of writing modules. So snap-ins have kind of fallen by the wayside, and we've got this new concept called modules. And one of the things that is confusing as a developer is that a lot of the information out there about PowerShell is actually talking about the old snap-in model. So you kind of figure out which ones, who's talking about snap-ins and who's talking about modules, and then you can choose how you interpret the information. And there's some commandlets that a lot of websites will say, use this and you'll get this kind of benefit, which only work with snap-ins. Okay? So they kind of changed the model, but they changed it for a really good reason. What they learned was that a lot of people who were building wanted to build snap-ins really just wanted a container for a bunch of predefined scripts. And so the first level of building a PowerShell module is actually just writing a script. But instead of it being a PS1 file like we saw before, it becomes a PSM1 file. And then you can import that module and make it reusable across your application. Then you've got a binary module, which is very similar to the snap-in model, but a little bit simpler to write. And the ultimate option is a manifest module. And with a manifest module, you can either use a script or a binary as the basis of the customization. But the manifest provides additional information. So I'll walk through all these and it'll become a bit more clear. I would argue that if you're building a serious automation layer for your application, ultimately the manifest is where you want to go. Okay? It's not that much work to set up. In fact, I'll probably do it a couple of times in the demos here. Okay, so let's write our first module. So I mentioned before that a PowerShell script module is actually just a script file. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a module called helloworld.psm1. And in that, I'm going to write a function. So PowerShell has this concept of function, so you can create areas of reuse. And I'm going to call the function getMessage, so it kind of looks like a commandlet. Okay, it's just a convention. So all, and I didn't mention this earlier, but all commandlets follow a similar naming convention. They have a verb up front and a noun at the back. So every single PowerShell commandlet is like that. So get command, get child item, get member, measure object, group object, all of that kind of stuff. You'll see that. And in fact, you can actually, on the command prompt, tell the shell to tell you what the verbs are in the system that are commonly used. So I can say get verb, and there's a whole bunch of verbs. Okay. So now I've got my my PowerShell module, and what I'm going to do is write output hello world. So once again, it's a hello world demo. But this time, it's a reusable chunk of code. And now that I've got that, I can type in import module hello world. And if I type in get command, or in this case, it'll be get function, because it is a function. It's implemented as a function. So commandlets can be registered as functions, or they can actually be written in code. So that's the difference between your binary and your script. But what's happened here is I've now got a get message call that I can make and get the hello world output. So I've kind of imported that module. Now, if I had multiple functions in there, they would all be imported. So that's a script module, all right, really quite simple. And a lot of system administrators would have these sort of script modules in their back pocket. Okay. The next kind of module is actually a binary module, but I'm going to skip that and go straight to manifest module, because in creating the manifest module, we'll actually create a binary module. Okay. So the next thing I want to do is create a manifest. So I'm going to create issue the command new module manifest. And I give the module manifest a name. So I'm going to call this hello world. Now, a module manifest is, that's another kind of file called a PSD1 file. And it's basically, it's almost like a PowerShell version of JSON, right? So if I type in hello world.psd1 and notepad that, you can see we've got this, I'll just bump up the font there. So we've got this file. So in a manifest file, the purpose of the manifest is to provide additional details to the module loader so it knows how you want the module to behave. So you can plug in all sorts of rules here. So you can limit what, if you've got a file which has a whole bunch of functions in it, you can limit which functions are exported, for example. So the easiest way to get started is to actually just uncomment this root module section, and we type in hello world.psm1. And so what happens is when we load the hello world module, it looks at this and says, this is the manifest for the module, and here is where your implementation is. Okay, so it's saying it's just a pointer to the implementation plus the metadata. And that's really important, because if I go in here and type in get module, you can see that I've got a bunch of modules which are loaded, and you can see there I've got a hello world module. And it's a script module, and it's version 0.0. So there's no versioning information. There's no that kind of stuff comes through the manifest. What I'm going to do now is drop out of the command shell, go back in just to refresh the command shell, and I'm going to load the module via the PSD1 file, and you'll see straight away that there's more metadata coming through. Okay? So, get out of that. Okay, so I'm going to go import module, hello world, PSD1. And if I type in get module again, you can see now it's still a script module, but we've got some version information coming through. Okay, so that's what the purpose of a manifest is. And when I type in get module, I can format the output. So FT is a shortcut for format table. And I might want to just print out who the author is. So you can see that you've got my module there, and then Microsoft's two modules that are currently loaded into the environment. So that's a module manifest. If you're developing an application, typically you're going to want your PowerShell commandlets to access the API within your application. And so that means you're going to go from just doing purely manifest module to a manifest module pointing to a DLL. You could do it all with PowerShell scripting, but I find that once you start getting into the complexities of dealing with generic types and that kind of stuff, C# becomes a more productive programming language than PowerShell. Okay, so this progression that you go through. But there's no reason you can't sort of combine scripty parts and DLL parts into your manifest as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spin up an instance of Visual Studio, and we're going to go through getting that development cycle going. But for now, let's just make sure I've caught up on the decks. Okay, so we're moving on to commandlet development and debugging. When you're developing some custom commandlets in C# code, there's really three ingredients. You've got the class library, you've got the manifest, and you've got debugging script sessions, script settings. So that's just stuff that you want to do to remain productive when you're developing PowerShell commandlets. Okay. So what I'm going to do is flick back. Okay, so this demo is, this is about enabling that sort of F5 development scenario, right? So it's the thing I'm really keen on. So I'm going to start with a blank project. So a PowerShell commandlet implemented in C# is as simple as a class library. So flick back for that. So I'm in PowerShell. I'm just going to drop this code into directory here, and I'm going to call this hello world. So we're going to have a hello world subdirectory, and the class library, this is a convention that I use. There's no real rules about this, but one of the things that I inherited from the early days of PowerShell is doing something along the lines of hello world.management.automation. So a lot of the internals of PowerShell sit within a namespace called system.management.automation. So the base commandlet types. So I kind of mimic that in my own class library, so there's some alignment between the two. So sysadmin can actually look at the directory and say, ah, there's some PowerShell stuff there. All right. So I'll create that. And the first thing that we need to do is create our module manifest. So we're going to be creating a binary module, but we're going to load it through a module manifest. So I need to drop out into the shell. It's the easiest way of doing this. And I go into my hello world directory, and I've got my hello world management automation directory. And I go new module manifest, and we're just going to call it hello world.psd1. So that file will now exist on the disk, and I can include it in my class library. Now, I'm going to deliberately step over an issue here just to create an error later on, just a tip. But the first thing I'm going to do is add a reference. So all of the PowerShell classes that you typically need to deal with when you're building commandlet live in one DLL, and that DLL sits in program files. So if I go into list of recently accessed files, because you know I've done this before, you can see that rather than drilling down through program files, this is the directory path where the DLL that you want is after. Quick, write it down. If you just go on to Bing or whatever you want to search with and type in system.management.automation location, because a lot of people have trouble finding this, you'll find posts on it. But basically, if you go program files into your reference assemblies, Microsoft, Windows, PowerShell, blah, 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 you'll find this DLL. So we include that into our project. And this time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to implement a binary version of that get message commandlet. And we're going to do some more complicated commandlets a little bit later on. So I'm not going to worry about adding complexity at this stage. So we're going to take class one, and we're going to call this get message commandlet, like that. And to implement a commandlet, you need to derive from the commandlet-based class. Now, a lot of commandlets end up being very similar, so they take very similar arguments and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes you might want to consider having a hierarchy of commandlets that you use within your application, but don't overcomplicate it too early. So if you're writing commandlets that deal with one particular entity in the database, then you might have a base, you know, foo commandlet, and then have a new foo commandlet and a delete foo commandlet and that kind of stuff. But that's just that's stuff that you'll figure out anyway. So I'm going to create a commandlet. And the next thing I need to do is actually decorate the commandlet class with a commandlet attribute. And this is the thing that gives it the verb and noun syntax. So if I type in the verbs, the first verb is get, and the noun is message. Okay, and that's basically my commandlet done. If I execute that now, it would actually work, but it wouldn't actually print out any output. And so I need to override a method. So there's a whole bunch of methods in the PowerShell commandlet class, but the one that we want to override typically is called process record. And in process record, this is our opportunity to spit something out to the pipeline. And PowerShell just deals with objects, so I can actually just spit out a string. But I could also spit out a very complex object graph if I wanted to. But if I want to go write object, this is where I got confused previously, and type in hello world, away we go. So now I've done that, I just need to tell in the module to load the contents of the module from the actual DLL. So I'll type in hello world.management.automation.dll, and hey, I'll hit F5. But the problem with class libraries, of course, is that there's nothing to run. So if you're going to do PowerShell development debugging, you actually have to go into the debug settings, and you need to tell Visual Studio to start PowerShell. So we're going to type in C, Windows, System 30. So this is where the PowerShell.exe file is located. Windows, PowerShell, V, whatever, PowerShell.exe. Okay. And then the next thing we need to do is tell it to not exit. So when we hit F5, we want it to bring up the PowerShell command prompt, and that way we can interact with our module. So I hit F5. The debugger is now attached to the PowerShell process, and I'm in the debug directory. And so I need to do the same thing as I did previously. I need to import the module. Okay? And I'll type in hello world. And notice that there's no PSD1 file there. What's the step I've missed? I've accepted the default of not copying the PSD1 file to content. All right? So that's just a little tip that will make your life a little bit easier. But I could actually load the module directly from the DLL here. I just wouldn't get all the metadata that I want. And that's the difference between the old snap-in model and the new module model. Because with the snap-ins, you had the metadata about the extension in the DLL, whereas with the modules model, it's kind of external. I actually still prefer the new model because the manifests are much easier to work with. You don't have to deal with installer classes and registries and all of that kind of stuff. So we need to drop out of this. And we need to just change the properties of the module. So now when I run, I've got the debugger attached, and I'm going to say import module, and then hello world. Done it again, there we go. There's the module. And now when I call get command, I can search on message, I think that'll work. And you can see that I've now got my commandlet command there, and that's the one that's actually implemented in C#. And if I drop back into Visual Studio, and hit the breakpoint, whilst I execute that command, well, then it's going to hit the breakpoint. And that's what we want from a debugging experience for PowerShell. And from there, the sky's the limit. You can do all sorts of things. You can bring up IOC containers or whatever you want. So really, that's the basis of a good debugging experience. One thing I'll show you a little bit later on is actually using PowerShell script files to improve your developer productivity so that every time you hit F5, you actually do a whole bunch of automated operations like configure databases and that kind of stuff. So you always reset your environment to a baseline. We'll do that with Nerd Dinner. Okay. Who's with me so far? Yep, all right. Haven't lost anyone, that's good. We haven't progressed past Hello World yet, so we're going to get on to something interesting pretty soon. Okay, so the next thing that we need to think about is the design considerations for the commandlets. And I'm going to break out the old pen input in a second here. But basically, you need to think about these things when you're designing a PowerShell module. First of all, is the module that you're building going to be used directly on the server that you're managing, or you're expecting to have the PowerShell commandlets used remotely across the network, either via this thing called PowerShell remoting, which is a way of connecting to a remote machine using WS management and then issuing commands over the network and getting the results back, or potentially even having just PowerShell commands running locally that use some sort of web services API to talk to the server. So there's two quite different ways of doing it. You've got the PowerShell remoting API approach, or you've got commandlets that you run on the server which directly attack the system at the database level or whatever you need to do. The other consideration is, are you building commandlets for your internal DevOps team, or are you building commandlets that your external customers might use? So who works for an ISV here? A couple of people? Yeah, I mean, that's probably the right percentage. Most people work in the enterprise scenario, so this bit of advice won't necessarily be for everyone. But for those of you who are working in the ISV's place and you're building SaaS applications, sometimes if you want to, I guess, delegate some of the administration tasks to your customers' system administrators, well, then you might want to consider building PowerShell commandlets that they use. And those PowerShell commandlets would be quite different to the ones that you use internally to manage the SaaS application. They would be more focused on end user administration and that kind of stuff. So there's two kind of classes of PowerShell modules that you might want to write. A really good example of that is that you've got, you look at the Windows Azure PowerShell commandlets that Microsoft publish that get installed with Visual Studio, or you can download from the website. And they're quite focused on us managing our resources on Visual Studio. On Windows Azure. So the way that looks is, and I'll flick back to another machine here. It's got pen input. Oh, are you kidding me? Quite representative view. Success, all right. Try that again. Hopefully, presenter view doesn't come up. It did. All right. Bear with me. There we go. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is just quickly sketch out some of those architectural considerations. So if you've got, let's say you've got your firewall here, yeah? And you've got your server, and you have some clients out here, so this is a client PC, and you have your admin PC, so this is your internal admin. There's actually three different places you can install the PowerShell commandlets. You can install them on each of those machines. Now, if you're installing it on a client PC, the scenario you're probably talking about is managing a SaaS application, and it would use the API to on the actual application itself to manage information about the customer's tenant in a SaaS environment. The other option, and this the Office 365 team does this with some Exchange options, is you can actually use PowerShell remoting directly on your machine. But one of the things I would recommend is that you're very careful about setting up PowerShell remoting if you're building a SaaS application. You want to make sure you've considered the security implications, because if you make it too broad, well, then they might be able to do things that you don't want them to do on your server. So sometimes it's safer to deploy the PowerShell commandlets on the remote machine. You've got to make sure you do it properly. The next thing that scenario is, how's the administrator going to actually manage it behind the scenes? And so they might want to manage using the PowerShell commandlets on this machine and use the same sort of model as the client PC there, or they might remote desktop into this machine and issue the commands directly, okay? Or use PowerShell remoting. So they're the kind of design considerations you need to think about where you deploy your PowerShell commandlets. So the next thing we're going to look at is getting those custom modules deployed. So we're going to look at actually where you put these modules on the machine to either make them load automatically. What we've seen already is I've been manually importing the module. There's actually a couple of well-known locations on in the Windows environment where if you put your module in that directory, it's going to load automatically. Okay, and then we're going to look at a more complicated multi-tenant example with the time that we've got left, and I'm sure there'll be a little bit of Q&A. So custom module deployment. Let's look at the installation locations. If I drop into my machine here, and go into Windows, System 32, Windows PowerShell, under Windows PowerShell V1, there's actually a directory here with modules in it. Oops. If you dropped a file in that directory, it would load automatically every single time you went into a PowerShell command prompt. So you put your module in a subdirectory, and your manifest file or the script or the PSM1 file has to match the name of the directory for it to load properly. So that's why I called my PSD1 file Hello World, and I'd have a Hello World directory here where the hello world.psd1 file and the DLLs that were required for that module to work would sit. That's kind of a sledgehammer approach. I try to be a good little developer and not drop things all over the file system. So the other option that you might have is if you're building commandlets that are going to be used just by a user on a local machine, is actually drop them into the user's documents directory. So if I go into my user profile and go into documents, you can see that I've got a Windows PowerShell directory here, and I've created a modules folder. Now, you can actually put additional files in here. So you can put like a profile.ps1 file here, and every single time you bring up the PowerShell command prompt, it will actually invoke that PS1 file. So if you want to have a bunch of things that are run every single time, you work with PowerShell. But for deploying modules, you put them in a subdirectory, and the same rule applies. You'd have a Hello World directory. And so let's see if I can actually get this going with the previous little snippet of the simple script that I had. So if I go to sandboxes, demos, dev211, and we've got a script and a data file. Okay. And I'm going to drop them into the modules directory in a Hello World directory. There we go. And kill it off and load it up again. So if I go get module, we've got my PowerShell module. If I go get module list available, we've got a whole bunch of modules there. And we should have, if I've done it correctly, yeah, Hello World module there. It looks like I've not done it correctly. Well, we're done. Import module. Hello World. Okay. send message. Yeah, it worked, but I don't know why it's not showing up. Oh, script modules won't show up with the get module command. That's, anyway. Okay, so I think what was happening there, it was loading the PSM1 file instead of the PSD file, so we weren't getting any data about the module. So you'd probably have to rename the PSM1 file to a PS1 file, and then it would pull it in that way. So that's some of your deployment considerations. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is exposing, even though this is optimized for remote management and that kind of stuff, it's sometimes convenient to have the ability for a sysadmin to actually go to the start menu or search for your command prompt and just bring up a shell which is specifically dedicated to managing your application. So it might execute some initial commands. And in previous versions of PowerShell, you had this concept of a console file. So you could load all the snap-ins that you wanted to use, and then you would export your console and you get a PSC1 file. PSC1 files kind of haven't kept up to date with the module system. And so whilst I like the idea of having console files, they just don't work with new modules. And so if you want to build like a shortcut into the start menu somewhere, or the start screen, for your system administrators, what you need to do is create an icon which executes PowerShell with the no exit switch pointing to a PS1 file that executes the commands. And as we go through and do this next little demo here, you'll sort of see how you can pull that thing together. Okay. So the example I'm going to use here is pulling together a multi-tenant application that's Elastic. Sorry, it's a joke that we were having last night about elasticity not being a word. So we're going to create a set of PowerShell commandlets for managing nerddinner, and we're going to pretend that nerddinner is a multi-tenant application that's not. So we're going to be doing some crafty code just to make it behave like it might be. We'll just talk through some of the realities of building commandlets that talk to databases and that kind of stuff. And then we'll actually use a PowerShell command to create a record, for example. So how much time have we got? I've got a little bit of time. What we're going to do is we're going to go into Visual Studio, and I'll bring up a new instance. Close these guys off. Okay, clean up my environment a little bit. Oh, I better switch over. Okay, so hopefully everyone's familiar with nerddinner. It's hosted up on CodePlex. And it's my favorite application to pick on when I need random chunks of code to test against. So I get a source code, and I get the clone URL. And I go back into Visual Studio, and I'm going to clone that down to my local environment. And preview bits, wonderful. There we go. Okay, so I go into Team Explorer, connect, and I've already got a nerddinner repository here, so I'm going to create another one. So I've got a copy. And I'm going to click clone. And this is a good test for how fast the network here is on DemoNet. Do some tap dancing. If this files, I've got a backup plan. Everyone knew that Visual Studio now supports Git, right? Yep. It's awesome. There we go. It's going now. Okay, so I've got our environment set up. And I'm going to jump into the nerddinner2 directory that's created here. And the nerddinner application has two solutions, so it's got an MVC3 and an MVC4. They've been updating the version of MVC. And I'm just going to open up the version 4 application. So I'm going to run this now, just so we can get a feel for what the application looks like, see what we're dealing with here. Okay. So it's already got a nice F5 debug experience. It just comes up, uses local DB, and away you go. Okay, so the application's working. And I'm going to go back into Visual Studio, stop debugging, and we're going to add the management commandlets to this application. So step one. File, New Project, and Class Library, Nerd, Dinner, Management.automation. There we go. And the first thing that we're going to do is, because we want Nerd Dinner to be multi-tenant, is we're going to add the ability to create a database from the PowerShell command prompt. So normally when a system administrator has to, particularly an anti-framework application that automatically creates database files, they would have to go and change the connection string, bring the application up, and away she'd go. But in a multi-tenant scenario, you often want to have some sort of scripting interface to explicitly create a database that you're connecting to. And so that's one of the little commandlets that we're going to build. We're also going to build a commandlet that kills that database too, so if you want to remove a tenant. Okay. So the name of the commandlet will be new nerd dinner tenant commandlet. And like we did previously, we need to derive from the commandlet class, which means we need to reference it in the system management automation assembly. So we derive from commandlet. Okay, this happened to me last night. There's a little quirk in preview where IntelliSense crashes. So bear with me while I bring this back up again. There we go. So hello world's back. Sorry. This actually stumped me last night. As I was going through and just redoing the demos, I thought, what's happening? I did this so many times before, and I did some digging. It turns out that I'm using preview software. So I'm going to create a new nerd dinner tenant. Okay, so that's my commandlet. And then I'm obviously going to have some code that does the work. And we'll come back to that in a second. But I need to actually change my application to support creating multiple databases. And it just turns out that the way that the Nerd Dinner application is created, we've got to hack the data context a little bit just to work, make it work nicely. So I'm going to go up into the models directory in Nerd Dinner, and I'm going to go to the Nerd Dinner data context. Who's familiar with Entity Framework? Yep. So it's a pretty straightforward ORM most of the time. And I'm just going to pop in another constructor. And I'm going to type in, I'm going to accept a connection string. And I'm going to call a base constructor where I pass in the connection string. So it's basically the same as the constructor above, but it doesn't imply a default. And that's going to be useful in a multi-tenant application because based on where the user's hitting the application, you need to change which database you're connecting to. We're not going to go all the way through and building out Nerd Dinner to be itself to be multi-tenant. We're just going to focus on the PowerShell commandlets in the interest of time. So now that we've got that little bit of plumbing in place, what we need to do is in our PowerShell commandlet is use the Nerd Dinner data context to actually support creating a database. So I'm just going to quickly rename this. New Nerd Dinner tenant commandlet. And we're going to need to create a connection string. Now, this code that I'm going to write here is probably not exactly the way you'd probably want to write it in production. You'd want to have a couple more options around specifying servers and that kind of stuff. But I'm just going to hard code a convention for connection strings in the interest of just making it work locally. So the first thing we need to do is accept a parameter on our commandlet. So this is the first time we've dealt with parameters on commandlets in this session. And it's going to be a string. And it's going to be the tenant name. So when I create a new tenant, I just want to provide the tenant name. And for this commandlet, for this parameter to turn up in PowerShell, we need to decorate it with a parameter attribute. And then this commandlet won't function without this parameter, so we need to make it mandatory. There we go. So now we need to slap together a connection string based on the tenant name. So I'm just going to go connection string. Don't do this one at home. And go connection string format. We're going to go server equals local. So I've got a local SQL server instance here just for this purpose. and we're going to go nerd dinner and then underscore whatever. So nerd dinner underscore tenant. And that's often used in SaaS applications, so it's easy to identify what the tenant is that you're dealing with. And then integrated security, so SSPI. And this set of PowerShell commandlets that we're writing, because of the way I'm writing it, would work best installed on the actual application server itself. And if I've provided an extra parameter for the server name, it could be installed on another machine, potentially. But it's talking about using direct SQL database connections to do its work. So it's one of those ones that you would install on the application server or something that has access to the application server directly. And then I pass in the tenant name. And PowerShell is going to take care of making sure that the tenant name is actually provided. Okay, so that's PowerShell's responsibility. So writing the commandlet becomes a little bit easier. Okay, so we've got our connection string. So the next thing we're going to do is actually use the data context. So I'm going to say var context equals new nerd dinner context. And what's missing, I haven't added a reference to the solution. There we go. And to pump in the connection string. And all we're going to do is tell the context to create itself. It's as simple as that. So context, need to make sure I'm added in entity framework, which is always gets me, because otherwise we don't get all the good bits and pieces. So your automation library has dependencies just like in the hill. So I have to go install package entity framework version 5.0, I think what Nerdin uses. There we go. Awesome. And so now I should have my additional properties here. And I can go create if it doesn't exist. So it won't blow away a database that already exists. And so now I have to do some of those little bits of housekeeping. I need to create the module manifest. I need to set up the scripting environment, and that'll get us to where we need to be. So let's drop into the command prompt. We go into my sandboxes directory, go to nerd dinner 2, and go into MVC4, nerd dinner management automation, new module manifest, and we're going to call this nerddinner.psd1, and I'll include that in my project. There we go, and we have to tell it what the root module is. So in this case, it's the DLL file. So that's nerddinnermanagement.automation.dll. And just like I did last time, I actually have to set this so that it copies to the content directory. If you're building in setup packages and all of that kind of stuff, you'd bundle this into your setup package so it got deployed along with the application. And then, where am I at? So that's pretty much everything I need from the setup point of view, and I just need to set up my debugging environment. So the same as we did previously, C, Windows, System 32, Windows PowerShell v1, and then PowerShell.exe. And one of the things I often do just to make it a little bit more productive is I'd say no exit, but I also execute a command, which is just pre-import the module. So that way I get to the command prompt and the module's there ready to run. nerddinner.psd1. And if everything's been done correctly, when I hit go, I started the wrong thing. So one of the things I would recommend that you do with if you're doing PowerShell work is actually start the PowerShell command prompt up at the same time you start your website and all those kind of things. So it's just one of those things that spins up when you start debugging. So you set startup projects. There we go. Okay, and I should get a PowerShell command prompt up here. That's not what I want. So that looks like it's it. So if I call new nerd dinner tenant, now my PowerShell commandlet's there. And if I hit enter, it's going to ask me for the mandatory parameters that I need. So I'm just going to call this test one. And if I've done everything correctly, it should actually create a database on my machine. So it didn't crash, so that's a good sign. And if I go back into SQL Server here and refresh, nerd dinner test one. All right, so that's pretty much your multi-tenant scenario. You can get more complex from there. What we're going to do is we're going to cut and paste that commandlet, hack it a little bit, and make it so we can delete it, and then we're going to set it up so that every single time we debug the application, we create a bunch of databases or wipe them out if they're already there. So it's in that way resetting our environment. So obviously this is not a replacement for writing unit tests. That's the first thing I'd say. This is about live debugging the application. So that's sort of exploratory debugging. Go and shut that down. Okay, so how am I going for time? I've got 10 minutes. Okay. Thank you. I think I can do a cut and paste operation in 10 minutes. I'm going to change this commandlet to drop. Now, as it happens, drop is actually not a commonly used commandlet, so you'll see a warning when I actually load this module, which is quite interesting. So you probably have to use remove or delete or something like that to avoid that. So I've renamed the commandlet. And instead of going in here, I go context.database delete. Okay? And that will actually delete the database based on the tenant name that I've specified. So if I hit F5, okay, so see that I've got the warning there? PowerShell preferences certain verbs for commandlets, and drop's not one of them. Okay, so I showed earlier where you can actually use the get verb commandlet to figure out what are the verbs are, and you kind of pick one from that list that makes sense. And that's just Microsoft trying to encourage some consistency in verbs. That's all it is. You can actually, there's no hard policy that says you can't use a verb. You could use a verb called fluffy ducks or whatever. It doesn't really matter. So now that I've got that, I'm going to type in drop nerd in a tenant, and I type in the tenant name. So this, I think it was test one was the name I used. And if it works, the database should actually disappear. So there's test one now, and I hit refresh, and the database is gone. All right, so ta-da, it's all working. Okay, I've got a few more minutes. I won't go, I mean, from this point, you can just go and make it do whatever you want with commands that you can create entities. In fact, I'll jump into a little example that I've got just so that you can see what a piece of code looks like that's actually creating a record inside a database. So I'll stop this project. And I think I've got nerd dinner. So this is one that I prepared earlier just for the purposes of a demonstration. And you can see here that I've got a new nerd dinner commandlet. Okay, so this is a commandlet that creates dinners. And so in this commandlet, I have a lot more parameters for all of the data that I want to insert to the database. And the code inside the process record method is pretty similar. It's grabbing a connection string, it's newing up a dinner entity, and it's dropping into the dinners collection and saving the changes. Okay, so what we're going to do is run this application. There's something else I've done here. I've actually created a demo.ps1 file. So when I set up my debug settings, instead of actually just importing the module, I actually execute this PowerShell script. And here you can see that I'm actually dropping all of the tenants that I've had previously and recreating a whole bunch. And then as a convenience, just to help me remember what commandlets I've got, I often issue the get command module and I just filter the results by the module that I'm working with. So every single time I debug the application, I get this command prompt that comes up, which has a nice list of things that I can do, as well as doing a whole bunch of prep work. So if I hit F5 on this, hopefully it works, and hopefully the code I've been writing doesn't interfere with it. So I've got the same thing with the drop here. And what it's actually doing is going and checking to see whether those databases exist, and if they do, dropping them. And if they don't exist, it's creating them. So now I'll actually have three test databases on this machine. So there you go. Okay? And this is the case I'm making for PowerShell improving developer productivity. When you go on F5 and debug an application, there's usually a whole bunch of things that needs to be arranged. And the nice thing about using PowerShell commandlets in the dev cycle is that you can actually plug those initialization routines every single time you debug. And you can make them smart so they don't do things wastefully. So if something's already set up, you don't need to do it again. They're the considerations that you've got. So if I bring up that command prompt that I brought, you can see that I've now got my my instances there. And I'm going to say new nerd dinner. I'm going to type in test one. So that's the tenant that I want to insert the record into. And I'm going to say geek lunch. Event date, 1st 2014, like anyone's going to be there. Hello world. Mitch. 555-555-1234. Address somewhere in the USA. And you can see I just hit the breakpoint there, F5 past that. And that record should now be asserted. So if we go into the test one database, go into the dinners table, and do a select all. It's not there, and what have I done? So what's probably happened is it's gone and created a database. There we go. Thanks, Richard. Yep. So that's obviously, if you're building a real multi-tenant application, you don't make it so that your application can randomly create databases on your SQL server. You'd actually put some protections in there. But for the purposes of this demonstration, that does the job. One of the things that I'd recommend you do, if you are building a multi-tenant application, it's just general architectural advice, is actually have a configuration database, which has the tenant name and the actual database, potentially even the connection string, but at least the database name and server, as well as a table of URLs that database is available on. And then you change your application code so that based on the URL that's coming in to hit the application, you choose which connection you use to connect to the database. And that's the essence of building a multi-tenant application. But you can use PowerShell as your management layer for your system administrators. That is pretty much all I wanted to cover today. We've got some time for questions. I'm actually presenting here in the next session, so I'm happy to hang around and answer questions if you've got more. So over to you guys. Thank you. Yep. Yeah, so the question was, is there any good documentation on securing remoting? I don't know, and that's my concern as well. So I've been able to get remoting up and running, but like you, I'm really concerned about the surface area that I might be exposing. And that's why I sort of had that design consideration. If you're building commandlets that are going to be used by the outside world, consider just having a specialist PowerShell module that uses your application's API so you can constrain the surface area. They do this PowerShell remoting thing. The only time I've seen PowerShell remoting used in the wild, like in a very public way, is on Office 365. And I'd hope those guys know what they're doing. But interestingly, the reason they did it is for exactly the same reason that I mentioned earlier. It's actually easier doing that than building a UI for a lot of that stuff. So, you know, they're heading in the right direction. I would love to see them publish more guidance.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Is PowerShell backwards compatible? So if I run it on, say, the latest OS in 2013, would it work in 2003?
Okay, so the question is it backwards compatible? Well, when you target, particularly the ways that I used it there, so I've got those module manifests, they only came through in PowerShell 3. So at the very least, that's going to baseline what version of the .NET runtime you're running against. I'm not sure whether PowerShell 3 works on Windows Server 2003. It's kind of getting a little bit long in the tooth now. So, yeah. But you can still build snap-ins the old way, right? And snap-ins will still work. So everything that I did here, you can actually do with a snap-in. So you'd just be using the old model to get that backwards compatibility. The other thing you've got to watch is what version of the runtime PowerShell is actually executing in.
The .NET runtime?
Yeah, because when you start it up, you can actually specify what version of the CLR you want it to run. Sure, so anything that you can get at from code, you can do, right? So if you had somewhere recorded in your application those last errors, it's really just a matter of however you want to get to that information. I think systems management tools that have dedicated monitoring might be a better solution for that kind of thing. So you're probably putting a lot of effort into doing things that other tools can do for you for free. So I'd probably focus more on the very application-specific things.
What about things like, I don't know, for example, say that's a running app and you want to set on for a number of applications.
Yeah, look, you could use it to do that. So what you'd have to do is actually have a way for that PowerShell commandlet to get into the process, or at least send a command to the process that's got that so it can change that value. I've done stuff like that before, particularly around mapping URLs. So let's say that I've got a multi-tenant application and I want it to be accessible on multiple URLs. I might want to add a URL and suddenly that application becomes available on that URL. So that's kind of like some dynamic configuration stuff that affects the internal running of the application as well as the hosting environment. So it's possible to do it. It's just you've got to figure out how you've got to get from the PowerShell process into your application's process to make any changes. Often going through the database and then triggering a configuration refresh that way is a good way of doing it. Because that way, if the application's offline, the configuration still has an impact. Absolutely. I'll get them uploaded to DemoNet. In fact, and if for some reason, if I don't do that, my email address, so you can follow up, because I'll have this code on my machine for a little while, is mitch.denny@rutify.net. So if for some reason it's not on DemoNet within the next 24 hours, email me and I'll sort you out.